Today is Wednesday, August 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up, VOA's Zlatissa Hoke reports on Russia and the G7.
Britain also opposes Russia's readmittance. London's ties with Moscow plummeted following the 2018 chemical poisoning of a former Russian spy in England.
Purdue Pharma, blamed by some as the main culprit for the opioid crisis in this country, says in a statement it's prepared to defend itself, but also sees little good in years of wasteful litigation and appeals. Purdue and other drug companies have been named in more than 2,000 suits filed by states, counties, and cities across the country. NBC reports that the privately held company is offered to settle for $10 billion to $12 billion. An attorney representing local governments says there is a gag order, but he does confirm that there are active settlement discussions.
And we'll have more on that story coming up. Well, we're going to start today with politics. President Donald Trump's path to re-election next year seems to be getting more complicated. The president continues to boast about a strong economy, despite warnings from a number of economists that the U.S. may be headed for a recession in 2020. And the president must now fend off a primary challenge from within his own party, from conservative radio talk show host and former Congressman Joe Walsh. We have VOA national correspondent Jim Malone with us here to talk about the president's re-election prospects. And thanks for joining us today, Jim.
Sure, Kim.
Well, Jim, let's start with the economy. You've reported extensively on presidential campaigns. Do political experts think the economy is a major factor in presidential elections?
Yes, for sure. In fact, historically, if you look back, when the country's in a recession, it's been very hard for an incumbent president to get reelected. On the other hand, when the country is doing well economically, an incumbent president generally has a great advantage, and none of them have been defeated, especially since World War II. So the state of the economy always says a lot about the state of the presidency.
And also, President Trump is saying that he really has bolstered the economy. So what is your response so far?
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at where the president goes on these rallies across the country, he's been doing it since he was elected. He boasts about the economy, the number of jobs created, the low unemployment rate, the rate of growth, personal income going up, the tax cuts that he got through Congress. All of these things have buttressed his case for re-election. And actually, the argument that a lot of Trump supporters make is, despite the statements he makes and when he goes and rages on Twitter, you know, you have to take into account the state of the economy. And if you vote against him, you would be risking that. And in fact, in recent rallies, Trump has told people, if you vote against me, you know, the economy is going to decline. It's going to get worse. But here's the issue now. We're seeing some signs of softening in the economy. And there are a number of economists now warning about 2020 that we could be headed for an economic recession. The president seems to be taking these warnings seriously, and it's causing a bit of chaos and frantic activity in the White House. He's very much desperate to show the economy remains strong because he knows his reelection prospects are directly tied to the economy.
Also, looking at his reelection prospects, for several months there has been chatter here in the U.S. about a possible Republican challenger to President Trump. One candidate has thrown his hat into the ring. Could you tell us more about this and really what it could mean for the president?
Yeah, the latest one is this former Congressman Joe Walsh. He's known for saying some incendiary things of his own as a radio talk show host. But here's the thing. He's a conservative and was a strong supporter of President Trump as he rose up through the ranks to become president. And now he's saying things like every time the president opens his mouth, he lies, and other very strong critiques coming from a conservative. I think that's the thing to note. It's not expected that he's going to make great inroads against the president, say, in the primaries. He may be nothing more than an irritant, but I do think that coming from a conservative critic, he's going to get some media attention, and that's probably an issue for the president. And he's actually, by the way, the second primary challenger. William Weld, the former Massachusetts governor, is also running, but he's a much more moderate to liberal contender who's critiquing the president from a different point of view.
Also, real quick, Jim, the president faces the threat of an impeachment vote and multiple investigations into the House in the House of Representatives. So what are your sources saying about these challenges?
The Democrats in Congress are still divided about impeachment, so we don't know where that's going to go. The polls of the public show that the country is not overwhelmingly for impeachment right now. Democrats may try to press ahead, though, because the more progressive members really do want to move on impeachment, and they also think it gives them more sort of power to investigate the president and the White House in the months ahead.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. It's VOA National Correspondent Jim Malone here with me in the studio. Well, Purdue Pharma, the maker of the drug OxyContin, and its owners, the Sackler family, are in discussions to settle hundreds of opioid lawsuits against the company for about $12 billion. The news about Purdue comes the same week a court in the U.S. state of Oklahoma found drug maker Johnson & Johnson liable for its role in opioid sales. He ordered the company to pay the state $572 million to cover treatment for addicts. It is the first company to be put on trial for allegedly aggressively marketing opioids as safe, and Johnson & Johnson lawyers plan to appeal. Tim McGuire with the Associated Press has more on the Purdue settlement talks.
Purdue Pharma, blamed by some as the main culprit for the opioid crisis in this country, says in a statement it's prepared to defend itself, but also sees little good in years of wasteful litigation and appeals. Purdue and other drug companies have been named in more than 2,000 suits filed by states, counties, and cities across the country. NBC reports that the privately held company is offered to settle for $10 billion to $12 billion. An attorney representing local government says there is a gag order, but he does confirm that there are active settlement discussions underway. Word of the talks comes a couple of months before the start of the first federal trial in Cleveland. I'm Tim McGuire.
Among the top stories in the world, Iran's foreign minister says his country is not seeking heightened tensions. An Italian charity ship rescued around 100 migrants in the Mediterranean, bringing the total number of migrants saved to over 200 this week. A solar power plant improves life for Syrian refugees in Jordan. And in Sudan, women in power are giving a greater voice to minorities. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Well, French President Emmanuel Macron says the European continent will never be stable and safe if its relationship with Russia is not resolved. Speaking to foreign diplomats following the end of the G7 summit, which France hosted, Macron acknowledged that some allies will reject any talks with Russia because of its aggression in Ukraine. During the G7 summit, U.S. President Donald Trump pushed for a readmission of Russia into the elite group. It was expelled from the G7 after the 2014 annexation of Ukraine's Crimea Peninsula. VOA's Zlatissa Hoke reports.
Moscow's continued interference in eastern Ukraine has fueled tensions with the West. But since taking office, Trump has pushed for improving U.S. relations with Russia, and he seems to have gotten some European leaders on board.
I think we must build a new model for security and trust in Europe. Because the European continent will never be stable and safe if we don't pacify and clarify our relationship with Russia. It's not in the interest of some of our allies. Let's be clear about this. Some will always push to impose more sanctions. That's in their interest, even if they're our friends, but it's not in ours.
EU Council President Donald Tusk, a politician from Poland, criticized Trump on Saturday for suggesting that Russia should be invited to G7 meetings.
Today, I will try to convince my interlocutors that it would be better to invite Ukraine, as a guest, of course, to the next G7 meeting to hear the opinion of the new president. I talked with him about it 2 days ago, and I know he would be very interested.
Britain also opposes Russia's readmittance. London's ties with Moscow plummeted following the 2018 chemical poisoning of a former Russian spy in England, a brazen act which Britain blames on the Kremlin. Macron said that Russia cannot be readmitted into the group as a full member in view of its actions in Britain and Ukraine, but he said pushing it away from Europe is a strategic error which has led Moscow to build alliances elsewhere. He said France wants to change that, and it is prepared to act on its own if Russia meets key conditions regarding the conflict in Ukraine.
To put it simply, we are not a power that considers that our friends' enemies are necessarily our own or that we are forbidden to talk to them. And I think that's the strength of France.
Macron said representatives of Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France will meet next month to discuss ways to peace in Ukraine. Trump's national security advisor John Bolton told Ukrainians Tuesday not to expect any solution from the Europeans anytime soon. During a visit to Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, Bolton said Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky should not rush into any action on eastern Ukraine. He also said President Trump might meet with Zelensky during a trip to Poland at the end of the week. Zlatica Hoch, VOA News, Washington.
Well, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has asked Queen Elizabeth to suspend Parliament in October and give a speech on the government's legislative agenda. The move has angered many in Britain who see it as an effort to halt efforts in Parliament to pass laws to prevent the country from leaving the European Union without a negotiated deal. As Charles de Ledesma of the Associated Press reports, one of the harshest critics of the move is John Bercow, the Speaker of the House of Commons.
He was not told in advance of Prime Minister Boris Johnson's decision. He says it is blindingly obvious that the purpose of the suspension will be to stop Parliament debating Brexit and performing its duty in shaping a course for the country. Bercow says Johnson should be seeking to establish his democratic credentials rather than undermining them. He adds shutting down Parliament would be an offence against the democratic process and the rights of lawmakers as the people's elected representatives. Charles de Ledesma, London.
This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A study recently published in the journal Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics suggests the thawing permafrost in Alaska is releasing emissions of nitrous oxide at a rate that's about 12 times higher than had been assumed. Nitrous oxide is considered the third most significant human-generated greenhouse gas behind carbon dioxide and methane. Climate scientists say greenhouse gases traps heat in the atmosphere and warms the planet. Lead author of the study, Jordan Wilkerson from Harvard University, said small increases in nitrous oxide emissions would have the same effect on climate change as a large plume of carbon dioxide. The study points out that once in the stratosphere, nitrous oxide combined with sunlight and oxygen also changes into nitrogen oxides, which may harm the ozone. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Tunisia holds its presidential elections on September 15th. Over 20 candidates are competing, but the focus is on few prominent figures who stand a better chance of getting enough votes to be considered for the top job in the new democracy. In the past, Ennahda Party, representing Tunisia's moderate Islams, do not nominate candidates for presidential elections. But this time, the party nominated Abdel Fattah Mourou, the first vice president of the Assembly of Representatives since 2014. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi spoke with Radwan Masmoudi, president of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy in Tunisia, about the major presidential candidates and what prompted moderate Islamists to nominate a candidate.
Well, I think the moderate Islamic party in Tunisia, which is called Ennahda Party, felt that the democratic transition in Tunisia is going smoothly and that the democratic traditions and institutions in the country have become strong enough to have a real competition between the various parties about the nominee and for the presidential position. And it felt that Mourou would be a good candidate. And therefore, it is only natural for a strong party in the country, in a democracy, to nominate a candidate. This does not mean that the candidate will necessarily win the election, but at least there will be a competition of ideas and a competition of programs. And the Tunisian people will have a chance to explore and discuss and decide which program and which candidate would be better for the position. So this is a healthy sign for a healthy democracy.
Incumbent Prime Minister Youssef Chahed has formed his own party after Nidaa Tunis party suspended his membership. Is he considered the main competitor to Ennahda candidate?
I think Prime Minister Youssef Chahed is one of the main competitors. I think he has a good chance of either winning the presidential competition for the presidential position or at least of having a very strong showing. There are several strong candidates from the secular parties who are competing for the position. I think this election will be a very, very tough competition for several parties. This is the first real democratic presidential election in Tunisia, where we will have real candidates and real programs. And I think Youssef Chahed has a good shot and a good chance of winning the position.
How about Abdelkrim Zebedi, a technocrat who has served twice since 2011 as defense minister? He enjoys the support of secular parties, including Nidaa Tunis.
Yes, I think Abdelkrim Zebedi is currently the minister of defense and has served even under Ben Ali prior to the revolution. I think he is also a favored candidate. He is popular and he's supported especially by the people in the Sahel, in the center of the country near Sousse. I think he will also get a strong showing, you know, somewhere between 10 and 20%. So we'll definitely have a second round where we will have the two top candidates run again in a second round to see who gets more than 50%. So the competition will be very tough and the results will be very close.
So what are the chances for Mahdi Jumaa, who was appointed acting prime minister in January 2014?
Yes, I mean, again, Mahdi Jumaa been very successful at building a strong political party, which is called Al Badil. For the last 3 years, he has been developing his base throughout the country and he has developed good and strong programs. He has been successful in attracting a lot of technocrats and a lot of intellectuals. I think he also has a strong chance. We are only 3 weeks away from the elections, but it's very hard to predict who will actually win. But again, Mahdi Jumaa, I think, will get at least 10 to 20% of the vote, and he has a strong chance of making it to the second round.
On what basis would the Tunisian voters pick their favorite candidate?
I think there are several criteria that are at the center of the discussion in Tunisia and on the minds of most voters. And number one is the economy. How do we jumpstart the economy? How do we get real economic growth? How do we create employment opportunities for young people? Number two will be how do we fight against corruption? And number three is how do we maintain the stability and the security of the country? So these three goals will be, I think, the center of the discussions over the next 3 weeks. Whoever convinces the Tunisian people that he has a better program and has a better idea on how to achieve these objectives, I think, will win the election.
That was Radwan Masmoudi, president of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy in Tunisia. He spoke with VOA's senior analyst, Mohammed Elshenawi. Well, a World Wildlife Conference has adopted dozens of resolutions aimed at protecting animal and plant species threatened with extinction. The meeting on CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, also tackled illegal international trade that threatens their survival. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the CITES conference in Geneva.
The United Nations reports about 1 million animal and plant species worldwide are threatened with extinction. The conference has responded to the rapid decline of iconic animals such as the giraffe, several species of sharks, and precious timber. It has revised the trade rules for dozens of wildlife species whose sustainability is threatened by overharvesting, overfishing, or overhunting. The conference also has expanded the capacity to fight illegal trade. CITES Secretary General Yvonne Higuero says illegal traders remain a force to be reckoned with. She praises the actions taken by representatives at the conference to combat the growing menace posed by the rapid pace with which wildlife crime is moving online.
For example, you adopted decisions on strengthening enforcement efforts for tortoises and freshwater turtles. You will also support efforts to tackle illegal trade in the subregions of West and Central Africa. This illegal trade affects elephant ivory and species such as pangolins, parrots, and rosewood. Another important decision was to establish the CITES Big Cat Task Force.
The task force, she explains, has a mandate to improve enforcement, tackle illegal trade, and promote collaboration on conserving tigers, lions, cheetahs, jaguars, and leopards. The illegal trade in wildlife is estimated to be worth up to $20 billion a year. Higuero says more needs to be done to assist countries to strengthen their criminal justice systems. She says more vigorous action will have to be taken to combat wildlife crime linked to the internet, which in today's digital world seems likely to increase.
I am pleased to note that CITES has now started to open a new digital front, both to more effectively regulate legal trade and to combat illegal trade. This will lead to more efficient border controls using modern technology-based approaches such as electronic risk management and targeted inspections.
CITES has some success stories under its belt. It notes vicuna populations in Bolivia, Peru, and parts of Argentina have been revived through sustainable use. Because of this, the conference has downlisted a regional vicuna population in Argentina, this from Appendix 1, which bans all commercial trade in at-risk species, to Appendix 2, which permits sustainable trade. The recovery of the American crocodile population of Mexico, which is seen as another conservation success, has been similarly downlisted to Appendix 2. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new koala tracking app and marsupial hospital are the latest moves to protect one of Australia's most famous native animals. The furry, tree-dwelling marsupials are in decline in eastern Australia, and authorities hope a multi-million dollar rescue plan will help to save them. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The app will help authorities map and track koala populations in New South Wales state, where the furry marsupials are in decline. Members of the public, as well as researchers, are encouraged to report koala sightings using the technology. The koala faces various threats, including loss of habitat, disease, road traffic accidents, and attacks by dogs. They're also susceptible to the impact of drought and climate change. In New South Wales and Queensland, the famous and distinctive animals are listed as vulnerable under national environment laws. In some areas, it's estimated that numbers have fallen by a quarter in the last 20 years. New South Wales Environment Minister Matt Keane hopes the app will provide an accurate picture of where the koalas are.
We're calling on the community to download the I Spy Koala app on their phones. That's about getting the community to go out in the wild, in our national parks, identify where koalas are, recorded in their app, so that we're better placed to protect them into the future. This is all about ensuring that the koalas can continue to thrive so that future generations can enjoy them. This is all part of the New South Wales Government's koala strategy, a $44 million investment in koalas, the biggest single investment of any government ever, to ensure that koalas are protected and grow into the future.
A new koala hospital is being built in Port Stephens, 180 kilometres north of Sydney, and will be part of a wildlife sanctuary that will open next year. There'll also be more research into chlamydia, a sexually transmitted disease that's infected many koalas. Fences to channel marsupials and other animals away from busy roads and into specially made wildlife tunnels will also be built. In parts of southern Australia, officials say there are too many koalas and that overabundant populations are damaging valuable types of trees. In some areas, there are programs that seek to reduce marsupial numbers. But further north, conservationists warn that the decline of the koala is an environmental emergency. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Rob McLean. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.